Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does an artist transform an idea into a finished work? The critically acclaimed PBS series Art 21, Art in the 21st Century, is about to launch its seventh season of programs designed to connect viewers with some of the most influential artists working today. The program takes viewers into studios, museums, rehearsal and performance spaces, but more importantly, it also takes us into their brains as they are invited to explain in their own words how they work and what ideas they wish to explore. Susan Solins is executive producer and curator of Art 21, which will air this season on KERA Channel 13 television on Tuesday nights at 10, starting October 28th. Susan is in town for an exclusive preview party hosted by the Goss Michael Foundation tonight at 7 at the Texas Theater in Dallas. You can RSVP to attend by emailing ruby@gossmichaelfoundation.org. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
You've spoken about the idea that artists can be creative role models for the rest of us. And I think that is a really appealing notion because it sort of takes them down from this role of simply genius that is inaccessible and turns them into people that we can admire for their human qualities.
Oh, well, that's a very interesting and lovely way of responding to that notion. I think there's a terrific example in this season coming up. Excuse me. And that is the artist Leonardo Drew, who grew up in a housing project in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Housing project of all horrors of horrors was surrounded by a dump. The town dumped all around the housing project. And there were always machines and trucks going up and down and dumping stuff. And I think kids scavenged in there because sometimes you found interesting stuff, you know. And anyway, Leonardo was born with an amazing facility to draw. And as a small child, even 5 years old, he was able to draw cartoon figures. And I think he earned pocket money, by selling these cartoon figures and things to the other kids who lived around him. And he was lucky enough to fall into an art program which was nearby. And he started painting. And as he said, there was a lot of stuff there to use. And a very generous thing. And by the time he was 12 or 14 years old, he was having exhibitions. The facility to draw and paint was incredible. Such talent. As he got older, he could have earned a huge amount of money as a cartoon artist, and he was approached by the various comic magazines, and he declined and went to college. And so he went to art school, in fact. And then he almost literally tied his hands. He decided he would not draw. He would not use this incredible talent and facility, that he would force himself to find other ways to express his ideas and to force himself to think anew, in effect. And I think that is a profound and very amazing story, that a young person would decline the talent and say, I can do that, but I'm not going to use it anymore. It's easy for me. I want to tackle the hard things, and I want to find out what I can really say with my work.
So what kind of work is Drew doing now?
Leonardo, he's a sculptor, and he's still challenging himself in the same way. He actually did a lot of work in San Antonio. He was there originally as part of the Art Pace program. And he one of the things he loved about San Antonio, and I guess he would love about any part of Texas, is the heat and the sun. And he would collect a lot of stuff to make sculpture with. And he had a studio that had, a flat roof. And he could put stuff out on the flat roof to sort of cook and marinate and change in response to the conditions, the atmospheric conditions. And sometimes things would stew and cook up there for a couple of years before he really liked the quality. So he made a lot of sculptures there. And he talks about, though, And now he talks about that aspect of his work as something he also no longer does, that it became too easy. He became known for it. And in the segment about him, you see a wonderful piece he made when he challenged himself to work with simply white paper, not with objects, found objects, and which he used as a kind of gigantic sculptural collage. So I think he's always challenging himself. And another very interesting aspect of his segment is that we filmed a huge kind of labyrinth-like sculpture that he made in his New York gallery about 2 years ago. And evidently, it was not only a culmination, it was an incredible thing. It went on for through the gallery spaces. It twined around through doorways and into rooms and out of rooms and into the next space. And you could walk through it, and it was bigger than you, and you could pass underneath and also stand back and look at it. And, well, he did that. It was a challenge. He was given the whole gallery to use. Down with that. Out it goes. It's not something that he wants to ever do again. It's onto the next challenge. So I think that kind of notion of let me not use what I'm good at and what and push myself to find the next idea and the next motion and the next project is a really good example of somebody who's a creative role model.
I don't want to diminish the brilliance of artists who are working today, but there might be even more people walking around out there who have the capacity to make art. What do you think distinguishes someone who is an artist from someone who chooses maybe the easier path of, you know, working in an office somewhere?
You know, very often there is no difference. I think many of us are artists in what we do. You no doubt are an artist in what you do every day here at the station. And I think that that the difference is that we tend to think of an artist as somebody who makes some kind of an object or some kind of an experience that we can participate in or look at or enjoy in that level. And I think we connect it with some, often connect art making with some sort of notion about beauty, though beauty is something very hard to define. And so I think all of us probably make beauty. Oh, I think there's a lovely, lovely quote in another one of the segments later in the series from Elliot Hundley, who's an artist in L.A. And he said, you know, anybody who's put a photograph or a cartoon or some kind of a sticky on the refrigerator knows how to make a collage. And I think that's an example of something we all do. I mean, how many homes have we been into where the parents have put all these images of their kids and or their kids' homework or their kids' drawings and made an arrangement on the refrigerator door of all these things? And that becomes an artwork in itself. So I think we're just not conscious of our art, ourselves as artists, but I think we probably all are.
You have at this point been in certainly dozens, probably hundreds of studios and workspaces and practice spaces. Is there, I mean, obviously they're different across media. Is there something they all have in common?
Wow. Well, they're places of action or thinking, so places of action and thought. Other than that, I think not. I mean, one example is that when I asked John Baldessari if he would like to be in the series, and John said, but Susan, I don't do anything all day.
Surely that's not true.
Surely it's not true. He said, I just sit in my chair. And I said, okay, then we will film you sitting in your chair. And we did. And of course, a lot of things happened all day long. But you know, I don't really think there's some people have a very solitary practice and they're all by themselves. Other artists might have a big team they work with, or they might call people in from time to time to help them make an object or even paint or whatever. So I think it really varies tremendously. Some artists don't have a studio.
Is everyone equally comfortable talking about how they think through their work?
Well, I don't really know. I'm not sure that I can answer that. When you talk to people, are they equally comfortable on the radio? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. I don't know. But what I have found is that simply paying attention to what they're doing, being a fly on the wall, in a sense, with the crew, trying to be back from the work and not to intrude, and then to be really interested in what they're doing makes it possible to have a conversation. And different artists will, just like different friends, will want to talk about different kinds of things. So I don't think anybody has been tremendously uncomfortable, and almost no one has said, no, thank you, I don't want to do this. So I think really there are only one or two people we've approached who have declined for one reason or another. So is it comfortable to have a camera crew in your studio? I don't think so. But are there ways that we can minimize the discomfort? Yes, and it's a very small crew. I work with one cameraman, a sound person, and if we need somebody to help with equipment, that person is usually very much in the background. And we really try not to intrude, so we're never in the face of the artist.
The show is very cerebral, and yet there's a real dramatic arc as we watch these works come into existence. And I realize that you have some time limitations and all, but we have the sense that we are there as these things come into existence. And I wonder if that's something that you have to think very deliberately about, or if in many cases that dramatic arc falls into place simply by showing a work at different stages of progress.
I think a dramatic arc is really hard to get to. It's not that there isn't a story in everybody's studio practice and work, but to create a piece for television, to create a segment or an hour-long program, which we've also done, that holds the interest of the viewer. I think that is a really, that's something that happens in the edit room. So we film a huge amount. We're also building archive, which is now our archive, the Art 21 archive, is now called the Art 21 Living Library because it's growing by leaps and bounds every day. In fact, while we're talking here, someone at Art 21 is no doubt filming. I mean, we're a tiny staff, but we're filming all the time with the artists we've worked with. So we continue to work with the artists once they've taken part in one part of our programming. Then we follow them. So we try to, if it's only every few years, we try to do a repeat engagement so that we can show how their work is progressing and their thinking is changing, if it is, or progressing in one way or another. So going back to the dramatic arc, I think that's an edit room thing, that you have to really be conscious of telling a story. And that story is something we have to find in the hours and hours and hours of footage that we have. But yes, there is some element, if you're lucky enough to be able to film something at the beginning, at its inception, and also be there in the middle and the end, of course there is a certain arc. But the segment on Katerina Grossa, who was here in Dallas and made a gorgeous installation
at the Nasher,
we were not able to see the beginning of that work, but we saw it installed on screen, and then we were able to go to her studio in Berlin. We also followed the progression of a work she was doing for a public space in New York. So in terms of the public space, we saw initial work, and we saw installation, and we saw the final piece with people, just the general public, walking by. So yes, there was one that had that. But
let me jump in. We have a quick break. Susan Solins is my guest. She's executive producer and curator of the PBS series Art 21. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
I've started started to work with my brother 3 years ago. He is an engineer. It's the first time I have somebody in my team who is not coming from an art context. He joined us when I was doing a huge project for the temporary Kunsthalle in Berlin, where we constructed ellipses that were leaning against walls, and the ellipses were about 30 feet high. We had to work with a boat builder and a structural engineer, putting them together and hoisting them into place. But that was a great moment. He has a really great way to connect the theoretical thinking that's needed to understand the engineering process, and he knows the language and all the words. And then he can still come back to me at the end of the day and say, look, we need that kind of bolt here.
That was painter and sculptor Caterina Grossa, as featured in an upcoming episode of Art 21, produced by my guest this hour, Susan Solins. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. Susan Solins is in town for a special screening of an upcoming episode tonight that will take place at the Texas Theater in Dallas. It is an exclusive preview party hosted by the Goss Michael Foundation. You can RSVP by emailing ruby at gossmichaelfoundation.org. Susan, I love the piece on Caterina Grossa, and I love that particular soundbite because it helps us remember that something that we as viewers of an exhibition see is just magic. It has just appeared there as if by serendipity, takes hard work, takes a lot of not simply creative thinking, but also acknowledgement of the realities of physics and science to make everything happen and stay where it needs to stay. To me, that makes the piece particularly interesting. And so I enjoyed sort of seeing in her studio all of that happening.
I see. Well, yes. And then there's another aspect of Caterina. She's been a teacher in Germany for many years. And at some point, there's a lot of material that doesn't always make it into the segment, and that's part of our Art 21 Living Library. But I thought it would be interesting to bring up some of that somehow didn't work in the storytelling. And we got onto the topic of the political and social and political. And Caterina, and I'm going to quote something from her because I think it's pretty interesting. She said, I've become very dubious about the idea that art might only have relevance if it touches upon the political aspect that we have as individuals on society. I find that art is very often misused. It sounds like this, the political social aspect, is the only thing that we deal with in our lives. I'd like to believe that the reason why we're here has to do with other things that are of spiritual nature. I'm trying to find out what I'm doing here and why I'm here. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Not that I would decry aspect of art making today that's social and political. And I think it has always been thus through the centuries that art has tackled social and political ideas. But I think we have several segments this time about artists who are working in that realm. But I do think this is pretty interesting that she's trying to figure out why she's here and that through the work she's trying to find the answers. And you see her painting with a huge spray paint gun kind of thing, and she's all suited up looking like she's on a space trip or something, so the paint is pretty toxic. She's painting in a very fluid way, and she's also, you also see her making sculpture in what is actually an old boat building facility in Rhode Island. And that I think this question of why I'm here is somehow captured in all of that. It's hard to put your finger on it, but there is definitely something spiritual about the concentration of her work process. And I think the pleasure of the color that she's using and the fluidity of that. And I think just thinking about the installation again here at the Nasher, if those of you in the public who saw it, think about the downstairs room that was a very strange and interesting landscape installation that was
a painted landscape installation of some kind that you had never experienced in the landscape. But I think as you went through it, you felt very connected to something rather awesome, and that might be the spiritual part.
Hmm. Are there frustrations for you in producing this series, knowing that even the best photography is limited by the fact that this two-dimensional medium is not the same as moving through, particularly with something like the Groza exhibition, it's not the same as the experience one would have walking oneself. And there's only so much of that that you can capture. And I wonder how you and your crew make decisions about how much to try to simulate the experience of people who would see the exhibition for themselves, and how much to sort of step back and follow other people going through the experience, if that makes sense.
Mm. Well, you know, I actually don't think we think about the person going through that. I think what we're trying to do is do the best job we can possibly do in conveying the feeling of that work of art and its impact and its qualities. And in order to do that, we have to use a camera. Right. And sometimes the camera sees better or sees differently than we do. And I think that's all to the good. I'm not saying we should all go with a camera in order to see, to look at art. But sometimes I've been amazed at the things that I've seen through the camera lens that I have not seen with my own eyes. That in a sense, by seen, I mean something that I've understood in a way that is somehow different. Very hard to articulate. But I think I don't think this is at all about simulating. I think it's about how can we best convey what this artist is doing. And that's the goal, and that's what I work on with camera crews. And it's gotten to the point over the years now where there's certain camera people who have shown that they are really passionately interested in this project and are really good and have developed the skills along with us as we developed our skills, because I have to mention that I was not a filmmaker. I started from scratch with this project and learned how to make films. So I think we've learned together, the crews and our staff, and I think it's been pretty much a good learning process, very powerful.
What are some of the things you've learned? How has the show evolved since season one?
Possibly it's more active in some way. And also, there are things that have changed that are more in program terms. For example, at the very beginning, I thought, well, we need to have famous, quote unquote, famous hosts, because otherwise nobody will turn it on. So, but how can we have a host and still get away from something that I really did not want to do at all, which was to have an explainer? No, there's no explainer.
There's no narration.
But the artist,
no narration.
So how can you have a host and not have narration? Oh, okay. Let's do something unusual. Let's put the host into some kind of a curious little setting. So, and work with an artist on that. So a good example is we asked Steve Martin if he would be host, and he agreed. I mean, amazing. He agreed. And we matched him up with William Wegman. And for those of the audience who know Bill Wegman and his dogs, I think they'll be pretty amused. And in fact, you can go to our website and look at this piece. And so what happened was Steve Martin sat at a desk, an ordinary kind of desk, and he said, "Welcome to my home." Well, you knew it wasn't his home because it was a pretty dinky desk and it was a very dinky lamp. And in the background was a window behind him. And there was a tractor, a kind of lawn mowing tractor going back and forth. And who was driving it but one of the Wegman dogs? And then Steve Martin said a few things about art and so on. And, oh, come into my home and let me show you my collection. And it was hilarious. And we did, for maybe one or two seasons, we did that sort of thing as a host introduction. And then we thought, well, you know, it doesn't seem to matter. We don't really need that. We need to concentrate on the artist. So I think that's one thing that happened, that we discovered that the power of the artist and the wish for people to have this knowledge and to share this experience with the artist was powerful enough.
to draw audience, and that we didn't need the celebrity person, but they surely were fun. One of them was, and I know the Dallas audience probably knows and has seen Laurie Anderson because she's been here a number of times. And so one of the really fun ones was Laurie Anderson leaning out of a billboard talking to the viewer. And that was hard to do, but very, very interesting getting Laurie, quote unquote, getting Laurie. I mean, it was all done through editing, but boy, that was amazing. So that has changed. And then the other thing was in the first season that here we were launching something called Art in the 21st Century, and the organization, because it started at the very end of the 20th and was going to exist in the 21st, organization is called Art 21. And I thought the first season, well, we better have 21 artists. Hmm. And that proved to be a rather foolish idea because it made the segments too short. And so over time, we have made longer segments about each artist, and we're now down to this season we have 12, and I think that's probably right. We've also done a one-hour program on William Kentridge, which was very successful, and I think there the reason why we thought a one-hour program would work is because William was involved in creating directing and creating the stage sets for the Shostakovich's opera, The Nose, at the Metropolitan Opera. And when we first started working with William, he was just also starting to work on that opera. So we could follow the development and be in the bottom rooms of the Met and see the first rehearsal and hear him introduce the opera to the singers and the actors at the Met, and also to see the stage sets being created both by him and by workers at the Met. So I think that was another kind of learning experience of telling a longer form story.
Do you have a wish list a mile long, given that you are creating this sort of living library and this archive for maybe future art historians to refer back to?
Well, it's definitely for future art historians. And in fact, we're working on trying to find funding for this project right now because it's going to be a very big digital problem. And it also is a research issue because we will have to have a team, and we think it will be university students who will help to tag what's in the archive, because there are 2,000 hours in the archive and we have only used 5% of the 2,000 hours in our programs to date. So this, and as I said before, the archive is growing. So, your question, going back to your question.
How you decide who to feature, given that you have limited resources.
Okay. Yes, indeed. Thank you for pointing that out. Indeed, we're very nonprofit and we're constantly searching for the funding for this project. And we also do a lot of education work, and we're teaching teachers how to use the materials in schools. So that also requires substantial funding. But right now, the associate curator in our office in Art 21, Wes Miller, who happens to come from Texas. Wes has been doing a huge amount of research, and I think the research base right now is about 3,000 artists around the world. So we have become increasingly international in the artists we work with, and we want to continue to do that to show art being made and artists as they work around the world.
Are there criteria that people have to meet in order to make the list?
I think that what we're looking for are artists who are, in a certain sense, leaders rather than followers. Artists who are, everyone is part of a tradition. Everybody has a historical chain of connections.
Sure.
You can't exist, and we can't exist as people without being aware of all of those predecessors. But I do think that my predilection and my interest is for artists who are changing the dynamic of how we think about art. So I'm looking for artists who really are making unique work and are pushing the boundaries. And so I think that's one of the things. So the series might lack in artists who simply make gorgeous paintings. And that maybe is a flaw.
And there's and I love gorgeous paintings just as much as anyone, you know. But so I think the artists we have worked with are really trying to find new ways of expressing what they need to express. And just I think Katerina's an example for those who saw the work at the Nasher. It's unique. It's extraordinarily different way of conceiving how you might go about creating a painting or a painted environment or even a sculptural environment.
What do you hear from teachers and students who use these in classroom settings? Because the pieces are challenging, even as they're really informative.
Well, in fact, what we have found, which is very heartwarming, is that students and teachers all over the place and people who've graduated from school are telling us that now that they grew up with this and how it has inspired them either to become artists or to become educators or to simply change the paradigm of thinking. And that is very, very exciting. But I'll give you an example. I mean, our materials are used from kindergarten right through grad school. And I hear from professors often, and I hear from teachers. And as I said, we have a program called Art 21 Educators, where we have been training teachers, and we're now up to about 75 teachers who've been through. It's a year-long course. And so about 75, I think 19 or 20 states plus Canada have been represented. And there's a wonderful – one of the things we asked teachers to do was to make short videos as an application, even if they don't know how to do it. So mm-hmm. with your cell phone, just part of the application is written and part of it is through video. And then we teach them to use small little cameras and as part of the summer intensive, which is the beginning of each year. And so they go back to the classroom to document what they do. And this is a long answer to your question, but we got back documentation from, I think, a fourth or fifth grade teacher who had shown Matthew Barney's work or some aspects of Matthew Barney's work to her fifth graders. This was an art class. And Matthew has a series called Drawing Restraints.
Let me jump in here. We have to take another quick break. My guest is Susan Solins, executive producer and curator of the PBS series Art 21, now in its seventh season. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
A very long time ago in the 60s, just as I was going through the transition from sculpture to performance, I went to the Southwest because I was doing research about other cultures and rituals. I saw the Hopi snake dance. They wear masks. It not only transforms the body, but they become something else. Masks made me feel more at ease and gave me the chance to create a kind of alter ego.
That was performance artist Joan Jonas, as featured in an upcoming episode of Art 21, produced by my guest, Susan Solins. She is executive producer and curator of the PBS series. KERA listeners can RSVP to attend a special exclusive preview party at the Texas Theater tonight, hosted by the Goss Michael Foundation. You can RSVP by emailing ruby@gossmichaelfoundation.org. Susan Solins, I do want to talk to you about Joan Jonas in a minute, but you started to tell us this great story about Matthew Barney and the relationship between a piece on Barney and a fifth grade class, is that right?
Which is pretty amazing because I think many adults find Matthew's work quite challenging. But the drawing restraints project that the teacher introduced the kids to was truly set them going. So what happened was that these children started figuring out how they could create restraints for themselves and then to make drawings or paintings being in this state of restraint. And so they did amazing things. Like one child decided to lie on top of a
a table, so quite high off the ground, and had had attached a long stick to either a paintbrush or a pen or pencil of some kind, and was lying there with the piece of paper down on the floor. You know, he was a couple feet away from it, and rather unsteady, leaning over the table and making a drawing. And two other kids tied themselves back to back and then started to make a work. And so all of this came after looking at the Matthew Barney and segment and or that aspect of it that the teacher found appropriate, and then being inspired to talk and to make something completely new and different in a way they would never have considered. So I think for the teacher, it broke a lot of barriers and boundaries and made the kids so excited about making art. And it was a brilliant thing and that she did, and completely, so well thought out. And I just found it a revelation. And so fortunately, as one of the things we have in our archive, we haven't even counted those hours of all the materials the teachers have sent back to us. But we have this. We can show it to you, the kids inventing restraints for themselves that cause them to create a completely new kind of drawings.
Wow. And I have to imagine the next time they look at anyone's art, they will think in a different way about what went into creating it.
I think not only when they look at art, but I think when they tackle the book they have to read for that class, or the mathematics that they have to do, whatever it is, I think, or just negotiating through a city or through your home or whatever it is, I think these experiences are really profound, and that they cause new things to happen in the brain. And this is exciting.
So tell us about the piece that you have coming up on Joan Jonas. First of all, we travel a bit with her through time, because there is archival footage of her back in the 60s, as she referred to in that cut we just heard.
Yeah. And you know what was really exciting was we worked with Joan over quite a long period of time. We finished the piece, and then guess what happened? We got the announcement that Joan Jonas had been chosen to be the U.S. representative at the Venice Biennale, which will be, oh my gosh, it will be this coming spring. Yeah, June, I guess. So anybody who can go and see this would be wonderful. So she has been chosen to create the installation for, or whatever it is that she wants to do for the U.S. Pavilion. So this is quite, we were so thrilled in for her, and also that we're able to preview her work for people who might not get there, and will have a chance to see it through our programming. So Joan, it's interesting that you introduced her as a performance artist, and she said in our various conversations that my main concern was a visual one. And she, yes, she's a performance artist, but she really is thinking as an artist who's always drawn. And I think when she was younger, she was a painter. She said, a lot of my work is influenced by painting, looking at composition and space and how the illusion of space is made. So where I think she's tagged a performance artist, actually her concern might be somewhat larger, quite larger, in fact. And that kind of reveal, I think, is important. And the fact that we could use archival footage and show her very first attempts and at creating a new kind of work. And that was very early video, and it's quite beautiful. And she was not a dancer, so she did not come from the performance side of the world, but she did send herself. She decided, she elected to go and take classes with some performance artists or dancers, more clearly stated dancers, in the 60s, and she chose really well. And her circle of friends included people like Steve Paxton and Tricia Brown. And she took classes with those people, Yvonne Rainer. And she said not very many, but it was enough to set her on another path. And I don't really know whether it's something I haven't discussed with her, but the provocation to go into this realm. I think it was very tough for women artists at the time to have their sculpture shown or their paintings, or very tough to get into a gallery, even though that world was quite a lot more open and less commercial in some ways than it is now. Still, very tough. And I don't know if that's part of, or the other thing, which I think is true, is that these artists, Tricia and Steve Paxton and Yvonne Rainer and others, were really, Merce Cunningham, were doing such amazing and wonderful performance work that I think it had to have been very inspiring to have seen that early work and to try to move into some aspects of that world. So she comes at it from a long history. She also has always been a person who does drawings. And one of the really very wonderful parts about the particular segment that we made about her work is that she, a few years ago, started working with the jazz pianist, musician Jason Moran. And Jason speaks about working together with her and what he has learned from Joan, and also what he has dedicated to Joan, what he has created after working with her. And I think it's a collaboration that is continuing on. So this was, and plus we also went to Sweden, to Scandinavia with Joan, where she was doing some performances of past works and also having large exhibitions. So studio to stage, to seeing the audience come in, to working with performers who were not classically trained performers, doing a work of hers and having a short period of time to teach them what to do and having that all come to fruition and be visible on camera. All of that is quite wonderful.
Do you have people lobbying you to explore the life, the mind, the work of their favorite contemporary artists?
I have a feeling that the Art 21 staff weeds that out.
They protect you from that.
But I think we might be known to be rather independent-minded. I'm not sure.
Are you aware of, the artists that you are working with are quite well-established, but are you aware of an effect that being featured on the program has on the careers of the artists you work with?
Oh, actually, they're not always well-established. For example, Trenton Doyle Hancock, who's a Texas artist who lives here, Trent was just practically... not practically. He was in school. He was finishing his degree in Houston, I think. He was in a studio program. So he was very young, but his work was already out in the world and amazing and unique and very special. So he was not known. And I think there are other artists who have not been that known. I don't think they have to be very established. But yes, I think, strangely, something happens as a result, because so many more people learn about their work through the program. So they do become better known. And in our other series, there's one called New York Close Up, which our staff works on and curates. And that one, we're starting to work with artists who are defined in part by being in the first 10 years of their working lives as artists. And they are living in New York in some ways. This is partly convenience that we can race out and film with somebody at short notice and not have to travel around the world. But it gives us an opportunity to both curate and look at young artists. And we have I think the show, that series has been extremely well curated by staff, and that as a result of having been selected and filmed, that yes, I think their careers have been influenced by that they have been seen by more people, and some of them have ended up with a museum show or a gallery show. Now, I don't say it's because of us, not at all. It's because of their work. And but nonetheless, I think maybe there's more getting out in the world as a result.
Are there subjects that you have briefly considered and said, no, I don't think so, and then re-engaged with and thought, I've overlooked something and gone back to?
The subject, no. I don't tend to think of subjects. The subjects come out of the curating process. It's not like I have a topic and then go out and select the artists. I don't think so. It's kind of organic process. And if one artist is selected, then and that
And then one is looking for an artist who is not that artist, who's mm-hmm. not making that work.
Yeah.
So it's a process. It's not a, there's no schema at the beginning of fitting people into a certain thing. It kind of grows organically.
Tell us a little bit about the upcoming season. Who else that we have not yet discussed will we see in season 7?
Oh my goodness, it's quite a roster. I think it's pretty interesting. Thomas Hirshhorn is one of the artists. The particular hour is called Investigation, and the juxtapositions of artists in that hour are very, very interesting. Each artist investigates in a different way. So Thomas Hirshhorn, who lives in Paris and is Swiss, and Graciela Iturbide, who is from Mexico, lives in Mexico City, is a photographer, and Leonardo Drew, who we've talked about. In the case of Thomas Hirshhorn, we were able to film over a good part of one summer where he was creating something called the Gramsci Monument with people who lived in a housing project in New York. And in that case, we had a long duration for filming. We were able to go back and forth a lot. And it's an effort which I think had a great deal of meaning for the people who lived there and who worked with him on the project. And I think has a great deal of meaning for all of us and as viewers, too. And so one of the things that was quite interesting were there were certain people who lived there who went every day, participated. Once this rather ramshackle structure had been created by Thomas and the team of workers he worked with up there, all of whom were paid salaries for the work they did, then all kinds of activities started from a weekly art class with Thomas, to philosopher coming to a little radio station that was producing conversations like this, and also playing music and performances of one kind or another, and all sorts of stuff, and ongoing art class for kids all summer. So once all of that started, there were people who attended everything. There were three women who we began to call the three graces or the mm-hmm. three fates. And those women had such interesting things to say. And the most profound, I hope I have a chance to get this out before the next break, I think was, I think for many people that Thomas's work could be perplexing. Why the Gramsci Monument? Why? What kind of monument is this thing, which people will see later in this series? Because it's a ramshackle structure that has a short duration. It's over a couple of months, and then it's dismantled and goes away. The one of the three graces said, I have to wait.
No, you don't have to wait. It's the end of the show, so can you get it out in 5 seconds?
Yes. She said, now I know what a monument is. It lives in your heart.
Lovely. Susan Solins is executive producer and curator of the PBS series Art 21. Susan, it's been such a pleasure to have you in today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect, and Shelley Canavy is our engineer today. We had help on the phones from Addie Sun. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.